ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, Lisa Leong here for This Working Life Rewind, helping to make your work life better. Lots of us feel like we're being micromanaged at work. So what's going on? Here's a look back at what we discovered.
Not motivated to keep going or to voice my own opinions or to do anything out of the norm. I was very much doing what I had to do and moved on. I think they call it like silent resigners. So eventually just leave and it don't provide much impact to the business by the time you've left.
Years ago, researcher Shona Ryan was feeling hemmed in by her boss. But at the time, she didn't know there was a label for her experience.
Because I'm aware of that type of leadership style now, I could have managed it once I saw those triggers and those kind of red flags. I could have raised it at the time. So yeah, I think a very slow spiral over weeks and weeks.
And Shona felt her confidence dwindling, her job satisfaction plummet, both symptoms of something she now knows comes from being micromanaged.
So micromanaging is where the manager or the leader is exerting excessive focus on observing and controlling people's behaviour in the workplace.
That's Dr. James Donald.
And I'm a senior lecturer in the discipline of work and organisational studies at the University of Sydney.
And James, have you ever been in a job where you felt micromanaged?
Well, I hate to admit it, Lisa, but I have more than a decade ago. And my boss was a very well-intentioned and in many ways a good manager. But I would say there was a tendency at times toward over-focusing on the sort of processes of things and the more minute, less strategically important. That's how I would think about it.
And how did it make you feel, James, at the time?
Well, it makes you second guess every decision that you take. It sort of creates this sort of sense of self-doubt, doesn't it? Where you're sort of looking over your proverbial shoulder with every decision or action that you take. It means that you're a lot slower in your work. You're less likely to make decisions. And then the other thing I found as well, which was interesting, was I would end up talking a lot more to my peers and sort of workshopping problems and so on a lot more. So sort of self-managing basically around it.
All right. Well, how prevalent is micromanaging in our workplaces, James?
Well, it is unfortunately fairly common, and particularly during the pandemic where people were working a lot more remotely, and of course that's continued in many sectors since, and the effect of that in a lot of cases ends up being managers wanting to control more. And so one survey done during the pandemic by a consulting firm found that, and this was a global survey, found that on average, just under 50% of employees felt that they were being micromanaged by their boss. And in OECD countries, you know, like the US, it was as high as two-thirds. So it's certainly a big problem. The other indicator that I pay attention to is global data on work engagement, because work engagement's a pretty good indication of how productive and sort of committed people are to their work. Like, I think it's a really good indicator of the health, if you like, of workplaces. And work engagement globally, and including in Australia, is it's stuck at around a third of people reporting feeling relatively disengaged in their work. And so that to me suggests that there's plenty of work to be done in this area and that it's a persistent challenge that we've really struggled to move the dial on.
And when does it tip into micromanaging as opposed to being a boss who's really just wanting to help you do your job to the best of your ability?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really the key issue here. No one wants to be a bad boss. No one sets out to be a micromanager at the beginning of their career. Staff rely on their bosses to provide clear direction and expectations and accountabilities. And so there is a very slippery slope, actually. I always see the difference as, you know, to what extent as a boss am I focusing on, you know, purpose, on the why of a request or a task, on accountabilities and outcomes, versus getting sort of drawn into the detail in a way that ends up being quite unstrategic. Like, the way I like to think about micromanagement is, because, you know, there might be times when we need to really, as a leader, be right across the detail on something. And so this idea that it's bad, period, I have a problem with. I think for me, the question is, like, when does it make sense? And it turns out that most of the time it doesn't make sense. When is it, you know, when is it strategically valuable versus not, would be how I would think about it. But it's just a misunderstanding around how people on the receiving end are feeling or experiencing your behavior. As I say, I don't think anyone sets out to be a micromanager. And so therefore, I think a lot of this stuff is happening as a product of the environment that contemporary managers find themselves in, as much as it is themselves.
To what extent is micromanaging more of an issue when you become more senior as a team member? So it seems like as a junior, I might want somebody to help me earlier in my career. And this is what happened to me, actually. So a junior lawyer had a really hands-on supervising partner, and that was fine. I mean, it was excessive, but I learned a lot. But then I noticed that he was having these stand-up fights with the senior lawyer in our team because he was basically giving them the same oversight, and it was too much for this senior lawyer.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's, as you say, it's about calibration. And yeah, when you're at the beginning of your career, a lot of people crave attention from their boss. And in fact, they need structure. You know, structure is one of the key sort of building blocks of healthy, engaged workplaces and teams, as well as clarity around goals and accountabilities. But as you say, you don't want to be a one-trick pony, do you? You want to be able to understand the dynamics that you're in. And as a leader, that can be hard when there's lots of other pressures going on. But yes, what your point here sort of traces back to this area of emotional intelligence, I would say, being able to see and assess the kind of needs that you have around you and how you might need to adjust your style and your behavior. And I think there's a tendency as well in a lot of organizations. You mentioned the law, but I think in others as well, in healthcare, we see it a lot, and in areas of the corporate world as well, where there's this sort of chronic risk aversion. And that it's a sort of an easy bet for a manager to go to, leaning towards overly managing their people around process here. So to the point we're talking about today, micromanaging them, because it's a sort of a risk-averse culture that they're operating in. And so the costs of doing that are often less, you know, they don't feel those costs directly themselves. And I think the problem with that, of course, is it disregards the longer term impacts. I mean, your example of working in the law around people feeling disengaged as they become more senior and progressing their careers, or, you know, looking elsewhere and those kinds of. So I think a challenge around this is micromanagement can serve us very well over the short term. And particularly in crisis type situations, it's needed. But the question, I think, for business and organizations is, what about the medium and longer term?
A lot of the literature had said, like, very much leader focus, and was like, this is a micromanager and they're because of X, Y, and Z. But like, a leader is a leading someone. So there's no point having a leader if you're not looking at the followers, or you're not looking at how the followers are reacting to that specific leader. So that's why I wanted to make sure to kind of twist the literature back to the followers and the actual employees.
That's Shona Ryan again. She did her thesis on millennials being micromanaged. Millennials are currently in the age group from late 20s to early 40s, and they're a growing part of our workforce. Shona noticed a gap in the research and wanted to highlight their experience. So she looked into a concept called followership styles.
So there was, I think it was Kelly, would had a paper on this kind of like four quadrants of followership styles. So the top left would have been like exemplary followership. So in general, they say that millennials are exemplary. So they're well able to kind of voice their opinions and to challenge their managers and to give feedback and to kind of say what they have to say, basically. And then the other extreme was alienated followers. So they're kind of the ones who are essentially yes people, they called it. So they just do as they say. Their relationship is very transactional and it's just do your job and leave. There's no kind of enthusiasm or anything like that. So they say millennials were the exemplary and then micromanagement created yes people or alienated followers. So then that's where the clash created between having micromanagers and millennials, and they're kind of not fitting into the quadrant that they wanted, that they should be in really.
And in your study, you asked millennial workers what they value most in the workplace. What were their top three things?
So the study was actually very clear. It was, I surveyed maybe 120 people. So it was a good lot of people. And I tried to position the question so that it wasn't very much like, do you like to be micromanaged? It was very, tried to do it quite slyly. So I think most, like 70 to 80% of millennials wanted autonomy, wanted to feel valued, wanted to be trusted. I think it was like maybe 97% said that if they felt they were removed from the decision-making or not involved in the decision-making, then they would be dissatisfied. So the findings were very clear in that people want the opposite of what a micromanager gives. So that was interesting. It was made by paper. It pretty much agreed with all of the literature that was up there.
Any other practical implications from your study, especially what we can do at an individual level, Shona?
As a manager, I think even millennial or not millennial, there's a lot of self-awareness that's needed for managers. So I think a lot of managers maybe get promoted without actually having the training, or maybe they're good at outputs and they have short-term results, but long-term, they're not thinking long-term or how this will impact employees. And especially, I think mental health and all that side of it is becoming a lot more kind of emphasized in the workplace, particularly because a lot of these issues do kind of tend to come to the workplace. So I think a lot of self-awareness, and businesses then should help. Again, everything comes out to training or learning and development and how managers can become more aware of how they're doing it. Maybe even having someone shadow meetings for a couple of weeks at a time to give that feedback to managers to say, maybe you positioned this feedback as criticism, and it could have been more as like a encouragement way of it, because that's what micromanagers do. It's very, this is wrong, this is the way to do it. But it should be more like, I think this, do you have any suggestions, and also welcome feedback, and try to make it more of a collaborative piece as well. Because in my paper as well, I found there was like in-group collaboration and out-group collaboration. So micromanagers had created a lot of out-group collaboration, which again was the transactional side of it, and more they're not involved in the decision-making, whereas in-group collaboration was that they're involved in the decision-making and they feel like they're making an impact into the business, and they feel responsible and they feel like they could stand over their work just because they're involved in this collaborative side of it as well.
Have you ever been micromanaged? It had a terrible effect on Shona Ryan in the early part of her career. Dr. James Donald from Sydney University has some ideas about how this style of leadership occurs and how to break the cycle. Let's hear what he has to say.
That removal of agency of the employee in terms of their own expertise and intelligence and all of the good things, the downstream effects of that show up in a few different ways. The most obvious way in which it tends to show up would be in terms of people feeling less confident in making decisions, in challenging assumptions, in asking questions. And all of that, and this is the research shows this, all of that adds up to less innovation. and therefore less productivity. People become more disengaged. This whole idea of presenteeism that we've been talking about for a while now, people sort of being there in body only, you're sort of heading in that direction. People withdraw effort, withdraw ideas, withdraw extra initiative for fear of being, reprimanded in certain ways. And so all of that has a big cost in terms of a team's productivity and in terms of a team's innovation. And when we think about our economy and, 70% of our economy being a services economy, where that's exactly what we want, that's a big cost. I think another important way it shows up is more in a social way. And so as a manager, you'll start to see, and as an employee, you'll certainly feel that you're less likely to go to your boss with a question. Micromanaging tasks can have a flow-on effect to the person's sort of well-being more broadly, and mean that, you're less likely to go to your boss with a personal problem that's actually quite important in terms of doing your job well. So I think that social outcome is actually a big piece of it. And what it means is that the managers are missing out on very important information about what's going on in their team. And what people end up doing is just self-managing themselves and with their peers. And that has a big social cost in terms of the team or the business's cohesion and the culture there.
And it sounds like, James, that this could become a downward spiral and, in fact, a vicious cycle of the person who is being micromanaged, their performance would get worse and worse and worse. So, in fact, having the opposite effect.
Absolutely. And this is the great irony. No one intends to be a micromanager. And most micromanagers that I've spoken to and that I've worked with, they do not intend to do this. They want the opposite. Yet it does tend to have this snowball effect, this sort of vicious cycle. And of course, the next step of withdrawal and presenteeism is looking for a job elsewhere. So it has this downstream effect around intentions to leave and actual turnover behaviours as well.
All right, let's say we're the individual who's on the receiving end. What can I do?
Yeah, and this can be a tough one, can't it? And of course, the context of your workplace, what kind of basis are you employed? If you're casual and so on, it makes it a lot harder. You've got a lot less, let's call it leverage. And it also goes to the culture of the organization as well. The starting point should ideally be having a conversation with your manager around this. And there may be good reasons why that's not possible, but a good place to start is always to find a way of sharing the impact of the behavior on yourself. So you're not accusing or you're not sort of assuming anything, but you're just describing your experience and some of the challenges around executing in your work. That can be quite a good place to begin in terms of providing feedback.
If we need to have that conversation, do you have any tips on how to have it or what we might say?
Some people like to sort of wait to the sort of quarterly performance review to sort of have this type of conversation. Other people, it's either more pressing or they feel safe, if you like, to have that type of a conversation on the go, call a meeting. Basically, I would say these couple of things would be how I would approach it. The first would be to flag that you're wanting to talk about something around your work and there's an issue basically, and then start to describe what's going on in your experience, in your role. And 9 times out of 10, that will open the door to a conversation around what's driving that. And if your boss still doesn't really want to hear or doesn't hear, you might then need to take the next step and say, I'm wondering whether we can talk about the way we're working together.
James, I would think at this point, if you're having a conversation, it would be quite dangerous and flaring to say, look, you're micromanaging me, or even worse, you are a micromanager, because then they'll get defensive thoughts, feelings around that.
Absolutely. So that's probably the last place you would want to go. So my sequence would always be start by describing your experience. first flag that there's something there, you know, like even just that flag thing can help the manager in their mind see, oh, there's a red flag here for the person. Number two, describing your experience. And so you're not accusing or assuming anything. And then thirdly, if they're still not really sort of hearing you or open to moving into this part of it, to say, look, I wonder whether we could talk about how we are working together, and you're still not assuming or accusing anything here. You're just saying, you know, there's, and then so you're opening an invitation to a conversation around how we're working together. And then from there, there are a number of options around how you can go.
James, if I'm the leader then, what are some steps I can take to manage people at work without micromanaging them?
So the first thing I would say is that whenever you're asking someone to do something, explain the purpose. And that is a very easy thing to forget. So it takes some effort, but it pays huge dividends. Because by explaining the purpose behind a request or a project or a priority or needing to shift someone from project A to project B, you are engaging their sense of agency psychologically. And that is a very powerful thing to do. I think a lot of people underestimate the power of that. So that would be the first thing to be always having in the back of my mind. The second thing would then be to be clear about, well, what are the accountabilities on Project B? And just be clear around, well, what the goalposts are. Often people slip into micromanagement because they haven't actually got clear on what they are wanting the person to do. So focusing on and thinking about, well, what are the outcomes that we're looking for here? That would be the second thing. Then the third thing would be to really let the person get on and do it. And they call this job crafting, this idea of allowing people to use their own intelligence and their own expertise to work out the best way of doing this task or doing this project and structuring it and so on. And so just as much as you can, allowing them to do that. And of course, you can be a sounding board, but the principle is you want to be reinforcing and supporting that sense of agency and encouraging that as well. And that's where the whole area of psychological safety comes in. You're reinforcing it's okay to make mistakes, to take risks, to try things, and all of those sorts of messages. In most organizations, this applies, of course. It might be different if you're, you know, doing some complex heart surgery or you're in a plane that's, you know, whose landing gear isn't going down. But in most contexts, right, that would be the principle. Then the last thing, the fourth thing I'd say as a manager that you would want to be very aware of is rescuing people. This is an important judgment to make. But if you find yourself rescuing people too much, you're then taking away their agency, their ability, their capacity, their opportunity to problem solve, to make mistakes, to find solutions to things. And of course, sometimes we need to go in and rescue. So that one around rescuing, I think, is a question rather than a sort of a principle or a dictate.
So how does Shona handle micromanaging armed with the knowledge she's gained through her research?
Now, in my current job, it's I'm very much in a in-group collaboration state. So it makes a big difference that I feel that I can stand over my decisions, and I also feel that I know kind of what's going on. So it's not like my manager is saying, can you do this? And then I just do it. I know kind of the background behind it. I know the reason why the business is doing this, and that's why I have more buy-in and I'm more inclined to stay in that role as well, because I believe in the business. I'm not just doing it just because my manager told me, that I'm more involved and I'm more able to have the autonomy to do the tasks as I want as well. There's the trust element, whereas I will get it done if as soon as I can get it done, and there won't be any issues with that. So I think there's not that conflict side of it. And then also, if I feel that there's issues, I will be open to raising them and voicing my opinions on them as well. So maybe it is, again, more awareness and more confidence and more able to stand up for myself as well.
Thanks to my guests, Employee Relations Specialist Shona Ryan and Dr. James Donald from Sydney University. And if you like this episode, check out the one about job crafting, a term James used earlier. We'll put up a link to that story as well. Thanks for listening to This Work in Life with me, Lisa Leong. It was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Michelle Weeks, and it was engineered by Carey Dell. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. And join me again next week for another story to help make your work life better. If you haven't already, search for This Working Life on the ABC Listen app. Tap the heart to follow all of our stories. Until then, love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.